The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
This, as you can see from the handout, is a 500-level course, which means that you can take it as a MDiv or MAR student, or you can take it as a THM and PhD student, in which case you'll have a little more work. So what the basic structure of the course will look like is some lectures, and many of the lectures will be interspersed with music examples and so on. Some class time will be devoted to discussion of a subject or a book, and I hope that you will feel free to interact, and you know, we're small enough groups so that we can be quite informal. It is in the apologetics department because much of the material relates to how Christianity interfaces with the world and how the Bible justifies certain aesthetic positions and critiques others. So it really is an apologetics course, not simply an introduction to music and not a worship thing. Jim Ward, our wonderful professor of church music, comes in the winters now to teach more hands-on principles of church music and how to conduct services and so on. But this is really more of a reflection course. As you can see, there's two basic requirements for the master's level and then an additional one for the PhD or MTH. The reading, three books, very different in character. The first by Peter Kivi, called Music Alone. He's a professor of aesthetics who has done a great deal of work on trying to understand how music conveys meaning. As far as I know, he's not a Christian, and a number of his conclusions would certainly not be compatible with the biblical position, but he raises questions and partially answers them in an extremely helpful way, I find. This book, Music Alone, is quite, it's a very deep book and somewhat complicated, but it's very entertaining as well because he takes three basic positions and he tries to illustrate them throughout and interact with them, and he gives them the names of characters and so on. So I think you'll enjoy it. The second book is a special issue that a review which comes out of Duke University produced. It's a review which is on theomusicology, the term coined by John Michael Spencer, who's a theomusicologist, someone who studies the... he coined it because I think he's the only one. His hope is to have a discipline that deals with music from a theological point of view. And this particular issue is a consideration of popular music in America from a theological point of view. It's not evangelical, but tremendous amount of insights there. And then finally, a grand old master of American church music who taught for years at the Westminster Choir College, Eric Routley, and he's published voluminously. And this is one of his best books. He guides us into some considerations about music and the church. So three very different kinds of books, but all centered around questions of aesthetics and a theological perspective. Now, I've given you due dates on this. If you could possibly do these, read them by the due dates, it really helps in the class discussion. Then a little examination. 3 hours, mostly essay questions. And that's it. Now, if you're a PhD student or an MTH student and you want to take this course for credit, then I'm asking you also to do a book review, and I've given you four possibilities here. I think there is one. Who talked to me the other day and said they were a PhD student? THM, yeah, okay, it was you. So, and if you want some help choosing the book, let me know. You know, we can discuss that. Okay, any questions?
Is this like a layperson's?
Yeah, it's not specialized. Yes, I should say that. This is not a course for musicians. This is a course for Westminster Seminary people, and it's an apologetics course, and I'll be focusing actually more on, well, as much on the question of beauty as on the question of music itself. Music will almost be an illustration of some more general principles. Now, if it gets too technical, you know, rattle the cage and say, wait a minute, what is this? But I don't think that's going to happen. So it does not require a special background. My dream is someday for Westminster Seminary to have a department of music and liturgy, and you know, there would be room for specialists, but as well as, you know, so, but I think that's probably a few years off. Such as?
Christian
Ed, and that's actually probably closer to being, to happening than music and liturgy, because it's something we've talked about for a long time. All right, I want to do two things with you today. A very brief thing, which would be kind of an introduction to the problems surrounding music in the modern world, and then a more thorough treatment of aesthetics. Okay, so music, its presence and its problems. Why would you give a course on music and aesthetics, and why especially at a seminary? Well, I think there are some obvious reasons, and then perhaps some less obvious ones. Obviously, future leaders in the church need to know something about the question of beauty and something about the question of music, if only to be able to guide others somewhat intelligently. Certain churches have elaborate music programs and will require a knowledgeable, self-conscious endeavor. Others don't, and maybe even have problems, but that also requires knowledge. Secondly, the choice of music and other artistic phenomena in a Christian setting is fluid today. There's a great deal of debate going on about preferences in the arts, in worship, the regulative principle, and so on. And I think at the root these are theological questions and cannot be avoided, especially since the Bible says a great deal about it. But then there's some less obvious reasons. The arts in general, and music in particular, are all around us. Music is in our living rooms, it's in weddings, it's in the automobile, it's in restaurants, in film, dances, parties, the Walkman, the church, MTV, advertisements, and so on. Some people even like to make music on instruments or sing. And because the arts are so pervasive, and music in particular, Christians simply cannot ignore it. And the temptation, as you know, is to rely on personal preference and what I like and bias, which is always useful to some extent, but is very limited in the bigger picture. Because if you're called to be a leader of God's people, you'll want to have something to say about their artistic life and not just about the principles of right and wrong. Now, musical life is in a state of some confusion today in the West and in America. Let me just mention how that confusion expresses itself. I think, first of all, our music is splintered, and various subcultures and genres interconnect, not just in society, but also within us. Think of some of the distinctions we often hear. Highbrow and lowbrow, recorded or live, or even interactive. genres like folk or rock or avant-garde, Christian music or Christian contemporary, jazz, opera, and so forth. What do all these things mean? Sometimes all of them are present through media such as the radio and television, and it kind of gives the impression of flattening them all out. So it's hard to know what to make of it. Think of one very particular example. How many of you are familiar with the classical music station WFLN here in Philadelphia? All right. What type of music do they play on it? Okay, that's true. It depends when you're listening to it. If you're listening to it in the early in the morning, what do you tend to hear? Yeah, and Dick James. But what kind of, what do they usually feature, say, during commuting hours? Pops, no, there's a bit of that, but it's all classical music. What kind of classical music? Symphonic? Easily recognizable. Very often it's Baroque, a lot of Vivaldi, a lot of stuff like that. And then during the middle of the day, it's the heavier stuff from the 19th century and so on. What's the format of the station? What sort of things do they do besides music on it? Yeah? Other art events? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay, because who are they appealing to, probably? Yeah, it's a yuppie station. I mean, their ads are for things like how to invest your money and so on. Also, it's the tone, if you listen carefully, is a sort of supposedly, yeah, right. What strikes me as well is not only how it aims at this sort of yuppie clientele, but the music is actually very limited. They don't play anything that's threatening. No avant-garde stuff. Really little or no music outside of the narrow 300-year limit of about, 1650 to 1950 or 1850. It's a very small segment. They don't go a lot into medieval music or chant, or they don't have any ethno music. It's no non-Westerns. The only foray they take into anything outside of classical is some very sophisticated jazz every now and then, and it's kind of a special deal. Now, this station, I think, banks a lot on what they think the audience requires, which is a bit of nostalgia, a bit of reinforcement security, feeling that they're not just wasting their time listening to those silly pop music stations. At the same time, it's familiar, so it's safe. Part of that is because you couldn't get a lot of people to listen to really serious classical music. Even in New York City, which is a much larger town than Philadelphia, there's sort of two major classical music stations, QXR and NCN, and the NCN just went out of business because they were playing too much alternative classical music, you know, too much of Beethoven trios as opposed to symphonies. People just couldn't handle it. They now are some sort of easy listening station of some kind. So this little window onto a modern radio program tells us something about the problem of music in the modern world. Music is culture. Music is used to reinforce and even to produce certain values in the minds of people. As such, a lot of deliberate choices are involved where we assume that they aren't necessarily. we could briefly corroborate this by looking at a very different kind of music or a different kind of medium. The medium of rock and roll is an awfully different kind of soundtrack, and it has its own stations and it has its own programs and its own audience, and there's all kinds of different rock and roll. There's not just one kind, but in the case, let's say, of MTV, there's a specific audience it's aimed at. It's a young audience, not a poor young audience, a fairly well-off young audience, an audience that is not likely to be much over 25 or 30, one which needs to be fed on some rebellion, and also needs to be reassured that, nevertheless, it's possible to coexist in the modern world despite one's rebelliousness. So it's not way out scary stuff. It's not like the very obscure rap stations, which are just angry and enraged and tell you to go and, you know, shoot your grandmother or something like that. It's somewhat safe, but it does go pretty far. I mean, probably a program like Beavis and Butthead is one of the most cynical and postmodern types of programs that you could have on modern television. And it consists of two young boys who are giving a running commentary for half an hour or an hour on all kinds of aspects of life with a little cynical laugh about everything. And one of the things that they do is to comment on video clips. And they'll show a pretty silly video clip and then make remarks that are based on a sort of teenage libido. This, too, shows that music is culture, but it shows that there's a particular choice, a deliberate choice being made about what audience to appeal to and what to do with the product. I don't know if any of you watched the other night the American Music Awards. Whitney Houston went away with a lot of it, and almost each time she got an award, she first thanked the Lord Jesus Christ, then her family, and then she thanked MTV and VH1. And what a combination! Yeah, I mean, what a trio! And there she is. She's a perfect product of, I think, a tremendous amount of confusion in the modern world of aesthetics. I work a good deal with materials coming out in professional musicology, and one of the things you notice, one of the emphases you notice, is that there's various schools of thought according to your political orientation or according to a particular scientific model. Joseph Kerman, K-E-R-M-A-N, has a book called Contemplating Music, which shows us a bewildering array of disciplines and sub-disciplines whose only purpose is really to talk about some aspect of music. So it's not just the music, but the science of music is fragmented and is based on these deliberate choices. Until recently, music was studied with fairly narrow categories. You had German music, you had Italian music, which was often a proving ground for things. French music was considered entertaining, not serious. Pop and jazz were outside of the purview of serious criticism. Today, that's not at all true. You have philosophical aesthetics. You have psychological schools like the behaviorist approach to music. You have ethnomusicology, which respects all kinds of different traditions and would never call French music just entertaining. It's a legitimate type of cultural expression. You have a huge school from Britain, the hermeneutical school. All of this, I think, reflects the confusion and the fragmentation in the academic world, which is an echo of the confusion and fragmentation in the artistic world. how do we fit in as Christians to all this? What do we do with this very confused and fragmented world? Sadly, I think often evangelical Christians are the last people to get on board an intelligent critique and the last people to look for a framework that really is deep enough to put all of this stuff in. And so we go by hunches and likes and dislikes and knee-jerk reactions. Or we go by things that are less than admirable, such as snob appeal. I was converted in a community which is just a wonderful place and had a profound effect on my life. But there was a subculture of that community which felt that only the music of the advanced Baroque was appropriate. And they had, most churches have two hymnals, the standard hymnal and then sort of a bunch of scripture songs. And this one had the hymnal and it had Bach chorales. And you walked into people's living rooms who lived in the community and you had prints of Rembrandt. And there was a sort of almost an ideology of what was acceptable as Christian art and what wasn't. And it was an attempt, I think, to react against the plastic culture of the 60s. But it subtly, I think, what crept into this was a sort of elitism and a kind of idea, well, if you don't have the aesthetic sense to appreciate Bach and Rembrandt, you're probably a second-class Christian. Now, the leadership of this movement didn't feel that way at all, but it was kind of a side effect. And that's an example of, I think, the way many of us react. Rather than being willing to go back to Scripture and do the painstaking work of finding out what the Bible really says, and to become acquainted with the various schools of aesthetics and find out what Christianity has to say about them. So what I'd like to do in this course is to do just that. Of course, it's frustratingly short because we don't have very many hours together, but I'd like to introduce us to some of the key notions and to get back to Scripture and see if it doesn't give us some clarity about our contemporary situation and give us some lights by which we can understand what's going on and maybe guide others. All right, let's talk a little bit about aesthetics. Art and aesthetics, in the meaning we give them today, are of recent vintage. The term art only came to be used in the modern sense at the end of the 18th century. And this is also the time when identification began to be made of the arts as the fine arts. Before that, going all the way back to Aristotle, let's say, art simply meant things made. They were crafted according to certain rules, and they were destined to become objects which might be useful or beautiful, and they could be material or intellectual. Material objects might be painting, architecture, sculpture, but also farming or decoration or clothing. Intellectual objects would come from the so-called liberal arts, which were either the trivium or the quadrivium. I know you're familiar with this, but the trivium was the three parts of the Greek academy: dialectic, grammar, and rhetoric. And the quadrivium was the four disciplines that every educated person would study: arithmetic, astronomy, geometry, and music. This is the ancient world, and it has its own prejudices and paradigms, as we'll see. But it's a world which it would be easy to regret because of what's happened since. A world where there's no real distinction between the high and the low arts and so on. Now, the term aesthetics was used for the first time in 1750 by a man who belonged to the Kantian school named A.G. Baumgarten. And it was the title of a book about taste, in which he explored the various dimensions of taste. In 1788, Immanuel Kant picks it up in his Critique of Pure Judgment. And here, for Kant, it's used as a way to judge the beautiful or the sublime. Now, this is all to say that art and aesthetics are recent terms. Aesthetics as a discipline is modern. However, critical reflection on aesthetic goes back as far as the first philosophers and as far abroad as any culture that we know. For our purposes, aesthetics would be any theoretical reflection on the matters of beauty and art. Now, aesthetics can be looked at in a number of ways. You could look at it philosophically. In fact, philosophy has had a privileged relation to aesthetics all along. Plato and Aristotle write in this vein, and more recent philosophers like Hegel, Heidegger, or Ernst Cassirer actually attempted systematic approaches to aesthetics. Hegel, for example, believed that nothing important happened in aesthetics until Kant. And at this point, he affirmed, philosophy itself is accomplished and fulfilled because of the arrival of aesthetic consciousness. And the great universal spirit, according to Hegel, is revealed through art itself. And the fine arts, as they're generated by artists, have a highly privileged position in bringing this Weltgeist, this great human rational spirit, to earth, by which the earth will be saved. It's a, if you're familiar with Hegel's scheme, it's a giant counterfeit, really, of Christian redemption. And it's just monumental and very fascinating. But for him, art and the artist has a key role in bringing humanity to its point of spiritual consciousness. So aesthetics can be looked at philosophically. It can also be considered historically. If we want to examine the very idea of the history of art, we've got to start with the relatively modern concept of chronology. So while what we call history is in some sense present in the earliest writings, not the least of which is the Bible, the specifically modern concept of chronology was born in the 16th century. That's when you have the first real historians. And just as historiography was born in the 16th century, so was the history of art. And you can identify one really key work which represents this modern chronological approach to the history of art, and it's a work that's well worth looking at if you're not familiar with it, by Vasari, and it's called Lives of the Artists, 1550, Giorgio Vasari, Lives of the Artists. It's a collection of biographies of what he calls the best architects, painters, Italian sculptors, and so on. And he begins with Cimabue and goes to the modern times, which is just a couple of generations later. Vasari believed that the present and the future had better art than the past. Actually, that kind of optimism was rare for his time. More characteristic of the 17th century. It was more common to believe in just the opposite, that things were better a few generations ago, and the present generation was a time of real artistic decadence. And that's, I think, something that present-day writers will often tell you. Things were great until my generation, then they all seemed to disintegrate. Music history was born a half century later. The first significant music historian was a fellow named Cephas Calvisius. Cephas Calvisius, who wrote De origine et progressu musicis, of the origin and progress of music, in 1600. A lot of other fascinating music historians in this period. One of my favorites is a fellow named Michael Praetorius, who wrote the Syntagma Musicum in 1615. He was a Lutheran who believed that the Bible gives you the basic framework within which to do music history, beginning with Jubal, the first musician, and going through David and so forth and all the others, and then getting to the modern period. He's one of the folks who believes that things went kind of downhill after the previous generation. And there are many others, which I won't cite for you. Marin Marcène and Athanasius Kircher and others. Now, in the successive centuries, histories of art are written with presuppositions that fit various agendas. In the 18th century, experts like Shaftesbury or Diderot wrote histories that were meant to guide the readers in matters of taste. They were sort of connoisseur's critiques for the layperson. And we still got a lot of that today. If you want to take a music course in college and you want to take the one that's the basic, you know, like music 101, it'll often be this kind of approach. For those of you who are not majoring in music, here's what the great music sounds like. We had one where I went to college. I didn't take it because I was actually a music major, but it was taught by this old guy, and he was a character. It was in the days of putting on the LP, and he would say, "Now listen to this wonderful Beethoven sonata," and then the needle would go, and I'm thinking, "Well, wait a minute, let's back up a little bit." And it was about 500 people in there, and they just, you know, they came out just loving all of classical music, and it was a connoisseur's critique for the layperson. In the age of Romanticism, in the 19th century, the artists themselves wrote about their own works, which was quite rare before. And they wrote about it in order to explain and defend their particular concerns. For example, Wagner wrote Zukunftsmusik, the music of the future, and had an elaborate theory that if you combined music and drama, you would have a kind of grand art that would bring humanity to a much higher plane. And Baudelaire wrote on art and literature. There's a lot of French art critics in the 19th century who were themselves poets. And it's very valuable stuff because they write from the point of view of artists. So you have the philosophical approach, you have the historical approach. Yet a third approach might be called cross-disciplinary. Today, many trends exist in that direction. The art object is considered before all else, but then artistic production is considered, and it's lined up with scientific disciplines such as sociology and psychology and semiotics. So there's schools of thought which deal, for example, with nothing but the psychology of art. I have a subscription to a magazine that deals only with the sociology of art, and it relates the arts to social patterns of all kinds. Of course, one of the very popular trends now is art and semiotics, symbol systems and hermeneutics and so on. If you look in the bookstores, you'll see that many titles can be found in a relatively new section called cultural analysis. And in general, books there study the arts as a part of the landscape. And this might include a feminist perspective on the arts, postmodernism in the arts, ethno-specific studies and deconstruction in the arts and so on. Now, to some extent, I believe there's validity to all three of these approaches, the philosophical, the historical, and the cross-disciplinary. Christians should be open to looking for insights from philosophical, historical, and cross-disciplinary studies in the arts. But I think we will especially be concerned to identify the underlying presuppositions involved both in the various approaches and in our own view. We will want to relate aesthetics to the ultimate question of truth, beauty and truth. We will want to understand the arts in relation to the created world, in relation to human nature, in relation to history, and most especially in relation to what God has revealed. So in order to facilitate that, I propose that we consider aesthetics through the matrix of worldviews. Now, if you've suffered with me in apologetics, you know something about worldviews, and you know that the modern anthropological study of worldviews has its own history and problems, but here I'm just considering it in the most basic and fundamental sense. My own beginning point stresses simply that human beings are basically driven by religion. The religious center of our being characterizes everything else, including culture and including the arts. And if we could assume this just for argument's sake, then what I'd like to do with you is to examine with you three models, three paradigms of aesthetics. These will be three systems which stem from basically different worldviews. And in relation to these, I'd like to compare responses that were made by Christians. These responses to the three different worldviews will be, on the one hand, partly beneficial, but on the other hand, I think partly quite flawed. At least compared to what a full-orbed biblical worldview requires. And then in conclusion, I'd like to suggest what a more thorough and biblically faithful view might look like. Now, this will probably take us more than today. It'll take us into next week. But please consider, nevertheless, how superficial this is in one sense. It'll seem probably very tied down to Western philosophy, unaware of some ethno-specific nature of art, not as sensitive to the women's perspective as it should be, and so on. But what I'm doing here is just taking these three rather classical views for the purpose of just getting started. Matter of fact, in my own work, I spend most of my time worrying about the other dimensions, but here I think it will just help to take some shortcuts. What are the three views that I want to look at? Well, the first is the classical model. This view was born in Greece in about the 14th century before Christ. Plato is the principal architect of the classical model, although many Greek philosophers, of course, worked on this. And the first thing to say about it is that questions of the beautiful and questions of art are not separate from the rest of philosophy. They're not even a part or a subsection of philosophy. They're identical, or at least coextensive with philosophy. And while Plato actually had a hard time convincing his readers of the crucial importance of philosophy, he was able to establish that being ontos is the center, the fundamental question of all human endeavor. Put very simply, being is the ultimate source of all truth. And being is the ultimate source of all beauty. Let's see how Plato sets this forth in a couple of his works. In one of his great dialogues, known as Hippias Major, nothing to do with, you know, Haight-Ashbury or the 60s. Hippias Major, an early dialogue, he discusses the essence of beauty. And I don't know if you've ever had a chance to read some of Plato's dialogues, but as I think C.S. Lewis once said, it's much easier to read philosophers than to read what philosophers have said about philosophers. And Plato's a great example of this because he's very readable and he's very entertaining. And this dialogue, like many of his others, is one that's quite accessible to the lay person. The discussion here is mostly negative at first. That is, both Hippias and Socrates, who are the people in the discussion, present inadequate views. Hippias gives three examples of beauty: a beautiful young woman, the beauty of gold, and the glory, or beauty, of an honorable life. And the example of this last one he uses is the honorable life expressed particularly in the beautiful funeral service that an honorable person should have. Now, these three examples of the beautiful woman, beauty of gold, and the beautiful funeral service of an honorable person are elaborated. And if you know the method that is used by Socrates and Plato, it's actually called the Socratic method. He kind of sets you up, and he takes you down a path, and then all of a sudden he says, "Well, what do you mean? Well, if you say that, then you're being absurd." Because, and then he shows you how, on your own grounds, it doesn't work. Socrates, in each of these cases, shows that none of the three are really universal, and so they can't qualify as beautiful. No one can, you know, quite get together and agree on, you know, what a beautiful woman is. No one really can agree that gold is beautiful for certain reasons. And who's honorable anyway, and so forth. So what's needed, he says, is not examples of beauty, but a basic principle. The real question is, how do you identify the beautiful and distinguish the beautiful from the ugly? We need not examples, but criteria. So to find this, you have to leave off, at least temporarily, beautiful things and discuss beauty itself. And this Socrates does by giving three more answers, each of them also inadequate. The first is ornaments or adornment. Now, these might seem to have a universal quality. They have the ability to make another thing beautiful. But ornamentation is a kind of fiction, he says, and has no real universal value. The second possibility is what he calls utility. You've got ornaments, which are weak because they only make something else beautiful, and you have utility. Are things useful, not things beautiful? Well, not really, because one could use something for good or evil, and it's not possible to use the beautiful for evil, or so he says. So finally, he tries a third example, which is pleasure, that is, the enjoyment of things seen or heard. Now, these come closer, he says, but they're not yet the same thing as the actual cause of beauty. So the third answer isn't right either. So what is beauty? Well, negatively, it's not a material thing, a decoration, a useful thing, or a pleasure. But the opposite of these is something that causes beauty, something universal, something absolute. Beauty, then, is an essential characteristic of the realm of the idea. Ideas and beauty are synonymous. In that sense, beauty is nowhere, but it is everywhere. It's not one realm or one sphere of life. It's always there. Beauty is ubiquitous. And this is true of all the great classical writers in their thinking about beauty. Aristotle, Leibniz, they all agreed that there is no separate theory of the beautiful, but rather the beauty of theory. We can understand the classical model if we realize that for the classical authors, reality is two-tiered. There's the concrete reality of things that we can feel and measure. That's the one level. And then there's the ideal. The ideal reality of things that are foundational. How do you get from the lower world of concrete reality to the higher world of essences? Well, two paths are recommended. The first path is knowledge. That is, the knowledge of definition. Definition means there's something in common between all the examples we could show, like we're sitting on chairs, but there is chairness, or there's lots of horses in the world, but there's the horse. This is the idea of the universal, which is in the particular. And in this dialogue, he goes so far as to say the actual discovery of a definition or of a universal is the occasion for wonder. And Plato has a long thing about wonder and awe. And part of the wonder of living in the universe is being able to discover definitions and universals. So that's the first path to gain this higher sphere. The second path to the universal is to begin from the world of inadequate natural things and then to look for its opposite. Measurable reality is insufficient to achieve the ideal because it's mixed or it's contingent or it's lower down on the scale. But if you recognize that, if you know how mixed and insufficient it is, then you're in line with the higher realm. So these are the two paths to get to the higher realm. Now, behind this ideal is being itself. Ideas are visible and they are beautiful. Beauty points to being. Beauty has no proper shape. It's a pointer to something more fundamental. If you put yourself in the way of beauty, you're putting yourself in the way of perfection. In other words, you're making yourself available to the great ideal. And the arts have tremendous power to move us towards this ideal. They do this because they imitate the ideal realm. So in the classical model, imitation is the key to what artists are actually doing when they create. The term that's used and that has been used ever since for this is mimesis, mimesis. Art imitates. And art takes you the viewer or the listener or the reader to the ideal realm because it shows you what that ideal realm looks like. When mimesis is properly functioning, the person viewing or hearing the work is actually improved morally. It's good for your soul. It makes you a better person. Let's show how this works in music, and then we'll have a break after that. And let's take another work besides Hippias Major, a more famous work, The Republic, Plato's Republic. In one's lifetime, it is imperative to have read at least once Plato's Republic, if only to get mad at it. In The Republic, Plato describes the power of music as a potential tool not only for good, but for evil. This imitation can go both ways. Ideally, of course, music should be used to educate the citizens of the Republic. Here's what he says in Book 3. Musical training is a more potent instrument than any other, because rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul on which they mightily fasten, imparting grace and making the soul of him who is rightly educated graceful, or of him who is ill-educated ungraceful. For Plato, in other words, music is so powerful that it could turn people one way or another. And if you were going to have a pure republic, pure music was needed. Technically, music does this because the notes on the scale exist in a kind of mathematical relationship. And these relationships, there are eight of them, they're known as modes. And each of the modes can make you do or think different things. There's a mode to make you happy, a mode to make you sad. There's a mode to make you disciplined. There's a mode that allows you to be promiscuous. This is the classical model, and a lot of variants exist. Aristotle modified certain aspects of it, and for example, he reproached Plato for being too vague. He wanted to free art to be more realistic and more literalistic. You might say that Aristotle became the father of Impressionism or Cubism, whereas Plato is the father of non-objective art, such as Kandinsky or Klee or Mondrian. But that is the classical view, and in fact, it's the majority view up until about the 18th century. So it's hugely important. Okay, let's take a little break here, and we'll come back after about 5 minutes. I told you that in each case, in each of these three models, there was a Christian variant or a Christian response. So this is particularly and preeminently true of the classical model. There is a Christian or a number of Christian variants. However, surprisingly maybe, the impact of Christendom brought no fundamental questioning of the classical model. Christianity, of course, challenged certain doctrines of antiquity. The Apostle Paul had, after all, compared the cross, which is God's wisdom, to the foolishness of Greek philosophy. And that contrast is radical. It's a contrast between Greek wisdom, which is always attained by climbing up a ladder into being. Remember, we talked about knowledge and so on. Going behind the veil. Remember in ST101, if you were in that course, we talked about the difference between revelation as God breaking through and unveiling as being our getting behind a mysterious veil, climbing up into the ideal. There's a radical difference between that and revelation, which is God breaking through into our realm. In fact, the God of classical philosophy is a kind of pure intellect, or thought thinking itself. Whereas the God of Revelation is a person, the Creator, who wants and wills to give life to everything because he's alive. But despite this very, very different starting point, the theory of beauty and art, which the great Christian thinkers believed, was really not radically different from the classical model. Instead, it was an attempt to present an improved, sort of Christianized version of it. At its best, it was a magnificent synthesis between Greek categories and Christian thought. Thomas Aquinas, I guess, is the pinnacle of this. You can compare Aquinas to the marvelous Gothic cathedral where everything has a place and every place has its thing. And you can see how in that system there is room for all the disparate elements from the pantheon of Greek philosophers to the apostles and saints under the same great building. And likewise, as medieval Christians thought about the arts, they incorporated the very best of the classical model with a kind of baptized, Christianized synthesis. At worst, however, it meant that the worldview of antiquity was never seriously challenged. Even the Reformation, which was certainly radical in sowing the seeds of a new epistemology, did not really challenge the classical model in aesthetics. Let me give you a brief example. Listen to John Calvin's views on music. I sort of hate to do this because it's very hard for me to disagree with Calvin on anything, but